Good evening. Tonight's shiur is going to be on the halachas of wills and inheritance, especially as the halachas apply to and for women. It's especially important. This topic is especially important for women because, for whatever reason, which maybe we'll touch on at some point, it's interesting that the Torah, when it describes the way nachala inheritance works, according to Torah, of course, has, call it a double standard, call it whatever you want to call it, but the halachas for men and for women as far as Yerusha goes, as far as inheritance goes, is not the same. And wealth is not necessarily divided according to the Torah law equally. And nevertheless, we see in our Masorah for the past hundreds and closer to 1,000 and in certain cases thousands of years, nevertheless have been sensitive to this, what seems to be unequal division, and we'll see how our Masorah has cultivated, has engineered ways to sort of equal the playing field with regards to inheritances and regards to creating wills that create a balance within a family that many people, certainly in our society, would seek. If you were to just ask me, why is it that the Torah has this inequality, I think the reason, at least the simplest level, there's certainly deeper levels which are not for here for now, but at least the simplest level, the practical level, is if wealth went, and we'll see how wealth is transferred from generation to generation in just a moment, but if wealth went equally to men and to women, to the children, both the male children and the female children alike, well, what would happen to a family's wealth if a daughter would inherit it, and she would be married to somebody else who's not in her family? Well, that family would then take over the entire wealth that she brought in, and then it would be, without going into details, whatever might happen later on, it might be subsumed into a different family. So therefore, this is my own idea, I just assume it's the simplest level, in order to keep wealth within a single family, it went along the genealogy according to the male children, as we'll see now. And we're going to get into all the details, so just hold your questions if you do for about 3 or 4 minutes as we get a general background how the halachas of Yerusha according to the Torah are engineered. So first of all, there are Psukim in Bamidbar, Chav Zayin, Perek Hay, and I'll give you just the 4 or 5 halachas that come out of these Psukim, and then we're going to have to see how that will play into lives in modern contemporary society. First of all, halacha number 1 in these psukim is that if there are both sons and daughters that are alive, only the sons will inherit. Daughters will not inherit according to Torah law. That's something very important to be aware of. If there's a family where there are no sons, but there are daughters, the daughters will inherit everything. If there is a family that doesn't have children, if there's a man or a woman or a couple that do not have children, then the one who will inherit if this man dies, will not be his wife. A wife, according to Torah law, does not inherit her husband. Rather, it will be the father of that man who passed away. So if a man dies, it goes to his sons. If he doesn't have sons, it goes to his daughters. If he has neither sons nor daughters, his entire wealth will not go to his wife, and that's going to be very important to see how we deal with that nowadays, but rather will go to the father's, this man who died, his father. If he doesn't have a father, it will go to one of the fathers, to the father's children. But again, not to the deceased's wife. So now, that's the outline that the Torah gives us, and now we have to figure out how are we going to apply it in our community? Thank you. How are we going to apply it in our community when we like dividing things equally? First of all, let's just ask some questions and then we'll talk about some other details. First of all, if there's a husband who has his wealth, regardless if there are children or not children, most often in our contemporary society, husbands prefer that their wife inherit them. And of course, God forbid later, at some time later, then the children will. But usually fathers don't want their wealth to go directly to their sons or daughters, but rather first to their wife. How do we do that in halacha? If according to the Torah, that is not the case in a natural setup of inheritance. That's first of all. Second of all, very applicable to everyone here, after Me'ev Esim Shana, God willing, a person goes to the Olam HaEmes and he wants to leave for his daughters. How is that going to be done if, according to Torah, that's not what's going to happen? Next question. Any of you here have any of you here oldest in your family? Any of you here have an oldest sister? Okay, so anyone who just raised their hand, there's no halacha of Bechor. Anyone here have an oldest brother? Okay, so your oldest brother is going to get, what? Double wrong. Correct. Thank you for saying exactly what I hoped you would say. Let's talk about how the halachas of Bechor work. The Torah says that an oldest son gets double. That does not mean that they get double. I'll explain it as follows. Let's say there's a family with 10 children. Let's talk about boys just to make life simple. There are 10 boys in the family. And let's say there's, how much should we leave? $10 million. $10 million and 10 boys. So how is this money going to be divided? Could I just change the numbers a little bit to make it easier for me? There are 9 boys and there's $10 million. So the way the halachas of a Bechor work is as follows. Every boy will get one of the $10 million. That's a total of 9. Then the Bechor will get a second share. The Bechor will get a second share of that $10 million, meaning the Bechor will get, again, let me rephrase it. Maybe you were right when you said double. It's not half of the, I apologize, I'm sorry, I think you did say it correctly. The Bechor will get $2 million, everybody, meaning 2/10. Everybody else will get 1/10. So the Bechor will get double what everybody else gets, but the Bechor does not get half of the Yerusha. So it's also important to realize that my son is the eldest. My son Menachem is the eldest of my children. He did not get a Pidyon HaBen because my wife is a Bas Kohen. Nevertheless, as far as the halachas of Bechor go, he would, after 120 years that I get to hang out here on this planet with you guys, he will be a Bechor as far as Nachla, as far as inheritance goes. It's also important to know that there are a lot of halachic permutations that will distinguish the halachas of Pidyon HaBen Bechor as opposed to Bechor for getting double. For example, a baby that gets a C-section is not considered Bechor for Pidyon HaBen because Pidyon HaBen, the Torah says, Peterechem, the first one to open up the womb, and therefore a C-section where the womb wasn't opened, rather they came into the abdomen to remove the baby, there will not be Pidyon HaBen, but the child is nevertheless a Bechor. Second situation where there's a distinction between Pidyon HaBen and Bechor for inheritance is in the following. Let's say there is a Bechor for the mother, but it's not the Bechor for a father. For example, let's say a man gets married and then has a second marriage. And in the second marriage, there's a Bechor born. Since he already had a Bechor from the first marriage, that's his Bechor as far as inheritance is concerned. Nevertheless, since that second marriage, that second wife had her first child, naturally, not through a C-section, that child will be a Bechor as it regards to Pidyon HaBen. So you could have a child for Pidyon HaBen who will be a Bechor, but will not be a Bechor for inheritance because only the first of the father is a Bechor for inheritance, but the firstborn of the mother is the Bechor for Pidyon HaBen. Question. What do you mean?
He wasn't
a Bechor, no? Yitzchak Avinu, Yitzchak and Esav.
No.
Right. I'm sorry, Yitzchak and Yishmael. Right. Yitzchak and Yishmael. So Yitzchak was not the firstborn, so therefore he ought not get the Bechora. That's true. According to these laws, he ought not get the Bechora. Whatever happened, there were... Definitely, yes, there's a pasuk that tells us that. There's a pasuk, ki b'yitzchak yikari l'chazara, and it could be that that's why you need the pasuk, because one might think that it ought to go to Yishmael. That's why you need the specific pasuk to tell you, to articulate that it's actually going to go to Yitzchak.
But beyond that,
do
you have anything else that explains why? Do
supersedes and overrides.
I think the fact of who they were, and we'll see how this is going to go later. We'll see how that works. So, based on the question that we were asking earlier, how could a person give to his wife, if the Torah, according to Torah law, a wife does not inherit her husband? How could a person give to his daughters, if according to Torah law, wealth is not assigned to daughters? So we're going to ask the same question. Let's say a parent wants to divide their wealth equally among all of their children, which is pretty much the common way to do things, and the safe way to do things if you want to prevent, you know, machlokas and psychological issues among children. So how could a parent divide their assets equally without favoring the Bechor? As the Torah says, the Bechor has to get twice as much as a second share of whatever everybody else is getting. Just to highlight the question, let's say you have a family where there's three boys. The oldest boy is fabulously wealthy, and the younger two are not. The oldest boy has more money than his father, and the other two kids are really, really struggling. So the father wants to give more to the younger children. So how could he do that? Those are going to be the questions. So we have three questions. We want to know how could wealth be assigned to a person's wife, how could wealth be assigned to daughters, and how could we readjust the double that the Bechor usually gets so that it's an equal playing field, that it's for all sons equally and not favoring the Bechor. Those are the three questions that we're going to have to deal with. Before we dwell on how to deal with the situation of what women do not get in the halachas of Yerusha, let's talk about the inverse. What is it in the Torah that women are specifically destined to get? What responses are there to the woman that will help understand how things are working in terms of the other financial issues out there? First of all, a woman whose husband predeceases her, so she has the rights to the ksuva. What's the value of the ksuva? The value of the ksuva is 100 zuz, which is then the person then accepts a second 100, 200 zuz. How much is 200 zuz? Well, it depends on the price of silver at any given point in time. I don't know if any of you have been following the what's happening right now. Gold is falling because until 3 weeks ago, gold was at its highest that it's ever been in all of history, and now because the stocks are rallying, so it works like this. When the stocks are not making any money, so you take your money out of stocks and you want to make them safe, you put it in gold. But when stocks are making money, so why keep it in gold, which is just standing there and not accruing value and not adding interest, so you take it out of gold into stocks, which is what's happened over the past few weeks when the S&P and the Dow have reached their record highs. So everyone's pulling the money out of gold, as of this week, back into the stock market, and therefore the value of gold is starting to fall. So I don't know what's happening in the silver market, but that's certainly what's happening in the gold market. I assume that as of now, as of this week, suvas are probably worth a little bit less than they were worth 3 weeks ago because of this being the case. But that's Ksuva is actually a chiyah from the Torah. That's first of all. Next, there are takanos that Chazal instituted before the time of the Gemara, during the Mishnayos, time of the Mishnayos, maybe even earlier, that after, God forbid, a husband passes on, his wife can be provided all of her needs, all of her basic needs, from the estate indefinitely. That means, even though we said a wife does not inherit anything from her husband, it all goes to the sons, but that estate that the sons inherited is under lien, L-I-E-N, to provide for their mother, for the wife, all of her basic needs as many years as she wants it. If she's going to stay claiming those basic needs for the next 50 years of her life, if that's the situation, then all of the money that the kids received as an inheritance are all going to go to their mother to provide her needs for the next 50 years. However, she will stop receiving those payments for her, you know, food, clothing, shelter. She'll stop receiving either at the point that she decides to remarry, or if she requests a lump sum payment for the ksuva, which, according to, let's say, the article that I saw from about a year or two ago, was in the range of $30,000. 25, 30, 33, that was the range that I saw, $30,000. So if she decides that she'd rather the lump sum, then she could forfeit her rights to being provided for indefinitely. Take the $30,000 cash now, and she will no longer receive her support. Or if she decides to get remarried, once she gets remarried, she also cannot continue to take from the estate that her husband left for her. The third area that a woman will receive is if there's an unmarried woman will be supported from her father's estate. Again, her father died, and there are brothers, they're going to inherit. The unmarried woman will be supported until they're 12 and a half years old. So everyone here, hopefully, their family will be till 120, Bezus Hashem. And nevertheless, even though the responsibility of the father's estate is only until the girl is what we call a bogeres, physically mature, which is at 12 and a half, nevertheless, there will be a dowry that the estate has to provide for their unmarried daughters for that person's wedding, which involves two things. First of all, it's a dowry to take into the marriage, and it's the wedding that the father would have, let's say, sponsored had he been alive. So, for example, let's say the brothers are being very stingy the way they're treating their sister. And they say, no, we just want a bare-bones wedding. And you know that the person knows that their father would have spent, you know, $250,000 on the flowers for the Badekin. So then they could demand that because that's what would have been the case had the father been around. So those are the things that a woman would get. So it's not as bare as it might have seemed if we just looked at the Pesukim of Yerusha. But nevertheless, we still want to see how we could engineer things to be more in sync with our contemporary mindsets. Let's start with a very simple question. Why can't we just write a will, a secular last will and testament that will provide for all the details that everybody in the world does? And by the way, at what age is it appropriate for a person to write a will? I'm giving a shiur to you, and it's definitely not appropriate to give a shiur to women at your age to talk about wills, but I happen to be giving a shiur on this tomorrow, so it helped me. Now you understand the secret. Everybody's thinking, like, why in the world is he doing this? I was like hoping for like Borer, or like maybe like, you know, Review Bishel, I don't know, something, you know. So why don't wills work? Why don't secular wills work? What is it about secular will? You've heard of the word term halachic will. What is a halachic will, and why does there need to be a halachic will? What's wrong with a secular will? First of all, what does a will mean? A will means a person, God forbid, dies, which happens to most people, certainly most of the people whom we know. At the point that they die, what happens? They're dead. After they're dead, there's a transfer of money from their estate to their inheritor's estate. And the will defines who their inheritors are. The problem is that in halacha, a person who is dead cannot make kinyanim, cannot offer, transfer ownership of property. Meaning, while a person is alive and kicking, they could transfer anything that they want to whomever they want. Once a person is dead, they, as a financial entity, as a financial being, no longer exist. They can't transfer anything to anybody. That's why the Torah had to create this parsha called Hilchos Yerusha, to tell us what happens when a person dies. It just automatically, the Torah transfers the wealth from the person to their inheritors, whoever the Torah declares as the inheritors, as the heirs. The person who's dead can't and doesn't pass on anything because they're unable to. That's the first issue. Secondly, isn't there a concept, let's say it doesn't make sense that, it's true, it doesn't make sense that a person, once they're dead, from a halachic perspective, could transfer ownership because they don't have any financial anything anymore once they're dead to make that transfer. But don't we have a concept in halacha called, what halachic concept do we have that should make the law of the land, even if it's not a Jewish law per se, but nevertheless if it's the law of the land, that should make something binding? Dina d'machusa dina. The law of the land is halacha. Dina d'machusa dina. So even, which certainly applies to financial matters, and this is certainly financial matters, it's a very big financial matter. Could be millions and millions of dollars. Could be tens of millions of dollars. I was speaking to a fellow recently, and they were talking to me about a certain family issue that they assured me was in the realm of tens of millions of dollars or more. And it's interesting that I don't know any people who have private deals with other people of tens of millions of dollars, but in terms of Yerusha, Yerusha is the entire estate. It's everything. It's the houses, it's the yachts, it's the planes, it's... I'm just talking about my own experiences. I don't know, you know, what wealth constitutes in your families, but the paintings on our walls. So why doesn't Dina de Malchusa Dina apply here? It's financial. So Dina de Malchusa, if it works anywhere, it definitely ought to work by financial issues. So let the law, every government has, and this goes back to, I mean, what the basic research I was doing was, like, this goes back to, like, Roman law, like, definitely 2,000 years ago had laws of inheritance. I'm saying probably even a lot earlier than that because we see it's in Chumash, so it makes sense that it would be in things that are shortly after Chumash as well. Maybe even any law codes that might be, I don't know, check the Hammurabi code, what it has for inheritance. But these laws are very, very old, and every country has it. So why can't we just follow their laws? If their laws state, if American law states that you follow a will, so follow a will. And even more so, if their law states that you divide wealth equally among all the children, or it goes first to the wife, and then, after both parents decease, goes to the children, so why can't we follow that pattern? The answer is as follows. There are two reasons why Dina de Malchusa Dina, following the law of the land, cannot apply specifically to inheritance, even though it does apply to a lot of other areas, financial areas of halacha. First of all, one of the reasons why Dina de Malchusa Dina was established is to make sure that if we're guests in a country, in a sovereign country, and they open their doors to allow Jews in and to allow Jews to operate businesses, etc., and to live there, if we don't abide by their laws, they're not going to like us, and they'll send us out as we... I mean, they've sent us out even if we were abiding their laws, but nevertheless, that was part of the sensitivity that Chazal saw to it to make the law of the land halachically binding on the Jew, so that we don't get thrown out of the lands where we are. That only applies, say many mefarshim, when you're interacting with people who are Gentile, so you have to make sure that they won't resent your having a different system, the Jews having a different system of law. So therefore, Dina de Malchusa Dina will be in force, will be in play. But if you're dealing with an interaction from one Jew to another Jew, as will almost always be the case of inheritance, by definition, it's one family, so it'll be one Jew with another Jew. So Dina de Malchusa doesn't exist in interactions between one and two Jews, and a second Jew. It only exists in interactions between a Jew and either a Gentile government, or a Jew and a Gentile. Hold on one second. The second reason, that's the first reason why Dina de Malchusa Dina will not apply to the Parsha of Yerusha. The second one, let's take questions. Yes, Shoshana. If a father has a non-Jewish child, excellent question. So if a father is married to, there's a man who has... let's say a lot of money, or not a lot of money, and he's married to, or he's living with a non-Jewish woman, and fathers a child to a non-Jewish woman, so the child is not Jewish. So who will Yarshin the father? According to Halacha, his wife anyway won't. That's certainly the case, because the wife never inherits. According to Halacha, they might not be his children, and therefore I'd have to check. I didn't look at it. I haven't seen anything about it in the past very long time. But if I just had to guess, I would guess it would be his brother. I'll tell you where something very interesting comes into play, and this is very important and very nogeh lahalacha. Let's say somebody's megayer, so somebody comes from a very wealthy family, and they are megayer. Let's say somebody, I was going to give an example of a name that many people know, of a very wealthy person who's very involved in very big things in the country, and they have a child who is Megayer, but I'm not going to mention the name. If anyone knows where I was going, great. So let's say there's somebody who's very wealthy and their child is Megayer. Now, according to Halacha, Gershon is Gayer, Kekotan Shenolad Dami. They're like a newborn, born again, if you want to call it, They're born again, they're newborn, they're not halachically related to their biological parents. So according to halacha, they ought not inherit from their biological parents. So now just imagine this in your mind. You have a person who struggles, has an internal struggle, and decides after a long struggle to commit to become Jewish. And they go through the Geirus process. And it's not easy, and they have whatever challenges they have as, you know, entering the Jewish community. And Baruch Hashem, they make through, and they work through their issues, and they make it happen, and here they are in the Jewish community. And all of a sudden, they get in the olden days, it would be a telegram. Nowadays, it would be an email. Text message. No, if a parent dies, they wouldn't text. So they'd get a phone call, email. So their father died, their mother died. So all of a sudden, they realize that there's $47.5 million at stake. And that's a lot of stake. So what concern might we have, we meaning Chazal? That's a tremendous nisayon for a person to be in, especially because they're the rightful, theoretically in a certain sense, the rightful heirs. So Chazal made a takana d'rabbanan that said that even though they are kekadon shenola dami, they're like a new born-again person, they will be permitted to take that inheritance so that they won't be what the Gemara calls chozer l'suram, going back to their original ways of, you know, we were concerned that they will leave the fold of Judaism that they joined, and they'd go back because of this incredible, incredible, incredible challenge, nisayon, and therefore midrabanan, they would inherit. But that's not your question. You're asking the opposite. If I had to guess, I would assume that if a Jewish man has non-Jewish children through a non-Jewish woman, then his brother will inherit him, or his father. But I'd have to double check that.
Was so much who would inherit as much as, like, in that situation, then do we treat Dina D'Malchus Adina differently? Because if the reasoning behind why we're not using Dina D'Malchus Adina in inheritance, because ordinarily it doesn't involve an interaction between Jews and non-Jews, then fine, but there are cases where it does.
That's an excellent question. You're asking maybe if we say that Dina D'Malchus doesn't apply because it's between two Jews. So you're saying in a case where there's an inheritance that is indeed between a Jew and a non-Jew, maybe we should apply Dina D'Malchus. That's a good question. I'd have to think about that. I don't have an answer.
There's no way of dealing with inheritance where we can halachically, like, most of the things that we say are Dina D'Malchus Adina are within halacha. So to write up a will that is within halacha, but just to have it physically written so that, you know,
we'll talk about that right now. It's you're half right and half not right. So we'll see right now. In general, Dina D'Malchus Adina would apply. You'll see. We'll talk about it right now. If we had our Sefer Bamidbar open, which I was actually toying with the idea of, you know, going through the Pesukim and the Chumash, because we have Chumashim here, but then people would say you go to Chumash class, and how terrible would that be? So at the end of the parasha of Nachala, of Yerusha, the pasuk describes Yerusha with the following two words, Chukas Mishpat. Chukas Mishpat. Now, we know the word Mishpat always refers to financial, interpersonal, things that make sense, logical, logical matters, certainly including things of financial nature. But the word Chok does not refer to that genre. The word chok usually refers to what we call in rabbi school iser v'heter, things that are mutter, things that are aser, kashra, things like that. That's chok. And sounds from this pasuk, chukas mishpat, that inheritance, the nachala, Yerusha, is not just financial. It's not just a matter of financial interactions between people. There's a qualitative distinction between regular interpersonal financial matters and Yerusha. Yerusha is like more like kashrus. Yerusha is more like taharas and mishpacha. Yerusha is more like shatnez. Yerusha is more like eating shrotzim than it is similar to financial interactions. And that's because it's not a matter of two people making a deal. It's not even a matter of you giving something over to somebody else or somebody giving to somebody else. It just happens. The Torah changes things One person dies, the Torah transfers, the person didn't, the deceased didn't, the Torah just transfers things almost magically, according to the Torah. That just transfers ownership. Therefore, you know what it's like? Since it's in the genre now, not of financial interaction, but of chok, of iser v'heter, let me back up. If I sell you something, can I make a condition? For example, I'm going to sell you a license to use a Microsoft productivity suite on the condition that only you and the people in your house use it. Do I have the right to make that condition?
Yes. As long as you put it like out there for the person we are selling it to know, and that's what they're paying for. Like.
Okay, let's try this. Could I sell you a cup of lemonade, but you could only have a lemon and not the aid?
And you're just selling the lemon?
What?
You're just selling the lemon.
The lemon flavor in the lemonade, yeah. Does it work? Does it work?
Who's going to buy that?
The answer is 100%. You can make that sale. When you have a sale with somebody else, you can make whatever stipulation you want. Because you're the one who's creating the sale. The other person is agreeing and therefore also creating the sale between the seller and the buyer. That is creating the sale. And therefore, you can make any stipulation, any t'nai, any condition that you want, and that condition will be binding between the two parties. But that's only in the area of mammon, of finances. Could I make a condition, let's say, I have a new solution to the aguna problem. Listen to this. Instead of people having a problem that they can't get a get, my solution will be, everyone should get married with a t'nai, with a stipulation, that if whatever, 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 then the marriage will just not need a get. That obviously doesn't work. Why not? Because you're dealing with something more than a financial interaction. You're dealing with iser v'heter. And on the inverse, could a person make the halacha is that a man would inherit the wife. Could a woman say, you know what, I want to get married, but I want to put a stipulation into the marriage that you're not going to be able to inherit me after I die. That also won't work. There are other ways that there are other... And we call them prenuptial agreements. There are other things that could be dealt with in order to appropriately keep assets where we want assets to be kept. But when you're dealing with something like a get, like a kiddushin, like something that's iser v'heter, you can't just put your own, you can't inject your own stipulations into that equation, only by financial matters. So, since the Torah calls Yerusha Chukas Mishpat, it has that iser v'heter, that religious ritual component to it, a person is not able to inject their own private stipulations. Well, what does that tell us? Just like it's iser v'heter that they can't put in stipulations, you know what else is significant about the fact that it's not just financial? That has this added dimension of this iser v'heter dimension? Well, it's no longer going to be subject to the laws of Dina d'malchus adina. Dina d'malchus adina don't make things kosher. If something is treif, and the government says everybody should eat horse meat on the annual horse day, when is horse day? Anyone know when horse day is? March. No one knows when horse day is? Groundhog day. Anyone know when Groundhog day? February 2nd. So let's say, oh good, so there is no horse day. So let's say on February 2nd, the Senate passes a law that everybody has to eat groundhog on February 2nd. Groundhog Day, it's appropriate. So does that mean that Dina d'Malchusa will obligate us to therefore eat groundhogs? Let's assume groundhogs aren't kosher. I think it's a fair assumption. Because if they chewed their cud, why would they have to come out and look at their shadows? It doesn't make sense. So just like it doesn't make sense that Dina d'Malchusa should require us to eat not kosher, Dina d'Malchusa shouldn't impact something that is defined as a kashrus issue, meaning a chok, which is Yerusha. And that's the second reason why Dina d'Malchusa, while secular law, will not be binding in an inheritance of a Jew, and that also is the reason why not just the laws of inheritance of the country, But that's also why a secular will not be effective in a Jewish family. However, there's always a however. There is a story in the Gemara that describes a will. When I say will, not like I will go to the store, but a will as in the last Old Testament, that describes a will that does work. There's I don't remember if he's a Tana or an Amora, Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka has a diuk from a pasuk, which is not important for us, who basically says, I'll tell you what his diuk is. The pasuk says, in what we were just describing, in the halachas of Yerusha, that the Yerusha shall be transferred biyom hanchilo es banav. On the day that he something or others to his children. What does hanchilo mean? Hanchilo, the hifil form, I assume it's hifil, my father teaches Hebrew, so I hope it's hifil. Hanchilo means that he gives over his nachala. That's hifil. Hifil is a causative word. Nifal is the door was closed. Hifil will be, I caused the door to be closed. So hanchilo is that let's say I'm the person who dies, I make my wealth be transferred to banav on that day. That's what the pasuk would mean. Ask to Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. That's not what happens. The Torah transfers. We said five times, the Torah is what transfers the ownership of the property from the father to the child. It's not that the father transferred it on the day he died. Says Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, it must be that the Torah is telling us that a father can indeed transfer things himself. And he can assign his own way of divvying up property. And you don't just have to follow these set rules that we said that just the boys and just, you know, double to this son and everyone else gets the next, whatever, one share, one portion of the rest. There is a way to have a will according to the Torah based on this pasuk, hanchilo, the father gives over the nachala. That's as follows. Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka says that at least among the people who are kosher yarshim, which again will only mean boys and will only mean the sons, the father can change percentages. Even though according to the Torah, the first son will get two portions and every other son will get one portion equally, B'yom HaNechilo Es Banav teaches us, says Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, that a father can say, if he so wishes, I want to give percentage X to this son, percentage X to this son, and percentage X to that son. He cannot say the words, I do not want my Bechor to get Bechora, to get double. He cannot say, I don't want that nasty middle son to get Bechora. He can't say it in the negative. But he can say in the positive, I want 20%, let's say the example we gave before, let's say his eldest son is very wealthy and doesn't need the money. And the younger sons, they're more strapped for cash. So the father cannot say, I don't want my eldest son to get, or I don't want him to get double. He can say, I would like my oldest son to get 1% and my next two sons to get 49.5% each. That would work. Well, that solves one of our three issues. We didn't figure out how to give a wife. We didn't figure out how to give a daughter, because this program only works to somebody who is a Yoresh. It also doesn't allow you to give monies upon death to tzedakahs. It doesn't allow you to give monies upon death to stuck or favorite nieces and nephews and cousins. It doesn't even allow you to give it to your favorite rabbi of your local Orthodox shul. We're going to have to figure out a different way to do that. So, besides the fact that we're limited only to people who are within the parasha of being Yoresh, there's another problem with this model, again, of saying that I want this percentage to go to that son, this percentage to go to that son, and a different percentage to go to a different son, all set in a positive verbiage. The other problem is that the Gemara is unsure if this works all the time or only by somebody who is a Shchiv Meira. Shchiv Meira is a term that's used certainly in the Gemara. I don't remember if the Mishnayos use it, but it means somebody, I won't say who's dying, but it means somebody who's very ill in bed. what's the problem with somebody who's very ill in bed? Well, we are very familiar with people, we're familiar with the concept of psychosomatic illness. But besides psychosomatic illness, there's also the fact that anxiety sometimes brings on more health issues. For example, if somebody is very nervous about something, their heart rate will change, and their breathing pattern will change. And we're worried, Chazal were worried, that people who are very ill, if they are going to think, oh my gosh, maybe I'm on my way out, and I didn't take care of my financial state of affairs, maybe, who knows what's going to happen, they're going to start hyperventilating, their blood is going to start racing, and who knows what's going to happen to them, God forbid, it could take a turn for worse. So Chazal said, don't worry. We're going to say, and we have the power called Hefker Bezdin Hefker, that whatever Bezdin declares in terms of transferring money from one to another works, even if there's no kinyan, and even if it shouldn't work, Bezdin has the ability just to transfer money through that power vested in them based on Pesukim. We will say that whatever a shchiv mara, this person who is lying there in bed sick, whatever he says he wants to be in terms of how his estate is going to be divided, it is automatically valid. As he said, no written documents, no will, no act of a kinyan, just his words themselves, midrabanan, have the power to give to whomever he wants to give or she wants to give. Anywhere, anyhow, whatever he wants. He says his favorite third dog, Maxine. Everyone know Maxine? The first dog didn't treat him right. The second dog wouldn't stay on the leash the way he should. And Maxine is just the most wonderful dog. And he wants his wealth to be, he wants Maxine to have a proper, you know what I mean, right? So he could, whatever he says about Maxine or she says about Maxine will be completely halakhically binding. Even though nothing else was there. So if he gets better later, that'll be a different issue. That's a different issue. So the Gemara, I just told you this whole story about Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, who says that you could figure out a way to divide up certain ways. Perhaps that only applies to this person, to the Shchiv Mara. Since he's a Shchiv Mara, and there's this dynamic of Hefker Bezdin Hefker that Chazal are saying, we're worried about his mental health, we're going to make things happen, so then we allow him to change Torah law. How the Nachala, how the Yerusha works is Torah law. We'll allow him to change it based on that power that we Chazal have, but maybe it doesn't apply to a regular person who's healthy, who wants to write a last will and testament and divvy up his assets or her assets however he or she wants. So what we come out with is that even though Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka says that there's a possibility of divvying up something, first of all, we're limited that it only works within the population of people who are Yerushim, which are male sons. That's the first limitation. Second of all, the whole thing might not work. The whole discussion of Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka's will of percentage to each son might only be limited to a Shchiv Mara, not to a regular person. So for this, let's talk about solutions, because that's what we need to end with. We need to end up with viable solutions. So first of all, what about just giving gifts? Could a person, people give gifts all the time to prevent estate taxes, which is smart because estate taxes could be as high as 40, close to 50%. So if they are getting older, it makes a lot of sense to give significant gifts to people so that the government won't collect, you know, a third of what they leave over to their family. So, could they give gifts? Well, 100%. A person could give any gift that they want according to, I think, the IRS code allows up to $13,600, something like that, of a gift per year. Are you an accountant? Yeah, okay, I saw you nodding, so I figured, yeah. Right, $13,600? $13,000, okay, thank you. $13,000 a year per person. So that means if a person has five children, each with five children, so that means they have 25 people. They could give each of those 25 people $13,000 per year, but they can't give anybody more than $13,000. If they do, then it's subject to a gift tax. Is that correct? They could do it, but it just there's. I'm sorry. Oh, it's more complicated. When I get older, you'll tell me. Okay. The problems with giving gifts are the following. Right now you give a gift, But maybe a year or two from now, whenever that person gives a gift now. But 2 years when they pass on, their financial status could be very different. Could be much better, much worse. That's A. So it's not going to take into account where a person will be when the time comes. Second of all, you're not going to be able to get an equal distribution because, again, you don't know. Right now, you could give a gift, equal gifts, but when a person dies, there's still going to be that differential between the bechor of whatever's left is going to be the differential of bechor of boys versus sons versus daughters. Thirdly, let's say there's a husband that gives gifts, whatever, he wants his wealth to go to his wife. Let's say he gives a gift and transfers financial ownership from his estate to her estate, from his wealth, from his financial assets to her assets. Well, what happens if they get divorced before he dies? So now he already gave her all of his assets, so gifts obviously work, but they have all these limitations. What about giving a gift that will happen after death? What? That's sort of what will. The problem is that once a person is dead, they can't give gifts. You don't own the money. You're not here. So you can't give anything. Finally, what about a gift that will, and listen to this so carefully, a gift that will be valid a moment before death? There's talk about this in the Gemara. The Gemara talks about that the people, the soldiers in David's time, would go to battle. And I think there might be, I don't know if they do this today, some yeshivas, has the yeshivas maybe. Let's say Israeli soldiers are going to battle. And they know that some aren't coming back, and some of them might be married, and some of them might not find their bodies, whatever it will be. The wives might need chalitzas if they don't have children yet, or if they don't turn up, then their wives will be agunas for the next, if they're 22 years old now, 25 years old now, for the next 70 years, God forbid, if they don't find the bodies, whatever, chas v'shalom. So, discussion is, maybe they could give a get before they leave, and this the Gemara talks about, this is what they actually did in David HaMelech's time. They give a get, the soldiers give a get before they leave, and what does the get say? You are hereby divorced a moment before I die. So therefore, if they don't die, they come back, so they just rip up the get. If they don't come back, then, if we know they died at least, then they were divorced, and therefore if they were divorced, there's no chalitza. If they were divorced, then there's no... You're right. If the body isn't found, it won't help. Because we don't know that they died. That's true. So hold on. I just want to finish up. So we could do the same thing. I could say I have I have $10 million. And I can't give gifts after I'm dead, so I can't have my will the way I want it. But a moment before... Right now I'm going to write, and I'll make it valid with a Kenyan, that a moment before I die, my $10 million will be divided however I want, to my daughters equally as my sons, and I'm not going to have favor my oldest because it's going to cause, you know, infighting among my children. Can I do that? Well, it sounds like it should work. However, first of all, there's a halacha, technical issue, that whenever you make a kinyan, if the kinyan isn't valid till later, it's that the kinyan doesn't always work, not for now. A second issue is something called breira. Breira means that if something is, I set something in motion now, but I don't even know what I'm setting into motion, it will only be determined later, then it can't work now. We're not going to get into that. It's a very complicated Gemara topic that I don't know anything about. But for those two reasons, a gift a moment before death will not work either. So, let's finish right now. How can a will work? What is a halachic will? I will tell you in 2 minutes what a halachic will is, and with that we'll finish. Halachic will is called, and this goes back hundreds and hundreds of years. It's the Ramah talks about it in the Shulchan Aruch. It's called a shtar chatzi zachar. A shtar document, that's a chatzi zachar, half of a male. Meaning a person wants to give to his son and his daughter equally. So he's going to give her half a male, and the guy will get the other half of a male, meaning portion. He'll divide everything equally. And this situation you could really engineer to give anyone you want, anything you want, in the same exact way that any secular will work, with just this simple addition. Let's say you want to give to your great niece and a certain amount to your daughter. You want to ignore your oldest son because he never called you before Shabbos. and your second son calls you every Erev Shabbos, you want to give him a huge amount, and your daughter, she's your daughter, so you want to give him her more than everybody else put together, you could do it as follows. You write a will, a secular will that is valid in your state. Then you take a different document, and you write the following. Let's say, how much do I own? How much do you think, what do you think I'm worth? Go ahead. So quiet. Okay, so let's say I'm worth $10 million, right? Give or take. Okay, fine. $20 million. So I'm worth $20 million. I'm going to write, and let's say by the time I die, I'll probably be worth 70. Look, I know all this stuff about gold. I know about tax-exempt gifts. I'm holding. So by the time I die, I'll be worth, let's say, $70 million. So I'm going to write a document that I owe. Do I have a volunteer? I owe Mrs. Schreier $80 million. How much do I have? 70. Okay, so I owe $80 million, and I put all of my wealth and my assets that I have now and that I will have at the time of death, all of my assets are under lien to that $80 million that I owe to Mrs. Schreier. Now, if I owe $80 million, what's going to happen to my sons and daughters when they inherit, according to Torah law, of course, they're going to inherit whatever they inherit. Where are they going to get their $1 or $2 or $3 million each? And then they're going to have to turn it all over to Mrs. Schreier because there's a pre-existing lien that pre-existed their Yerusha. So they get how much? In the end of the day, nothing. So you know what I do? I then add a second paragraph to this document that said I owe her $80 million. I said that if my children decide to follow my last will and testament, then I hereby do not owe, then Mrs. Schreier or whoever that person who is on the receiving end, you know, absolves them of that $80 million that they owe. So now what do you think they want to do? If they just take the Yerusha according to Torah law, then they have to pay $80 million, and they'll be left with how much? Negative. Zero. Negative, yeah, negative a lot. They're going to be left with nothing. But if they decide to follow my will and my last will and testament that is legally binding in the state of New York, then that obligation that I put upon myself vanishes. Because I made a stipulation that $80 million are only owed if they just want to follow the regular Yerusha. But if they don't want to follow the Yerusha, if they're willing to follow this document called my last will and testament, then that $80 million loan is non-existent. That's the stipulation I make. I don't owe it. And therefore, they'll get whatever it says in that last will and testament. That is called a halachic will. It has two paragraphs. The first paragraph says, I owe somebody a lot more money than I'm ever going to have. And the second paragraph says that if the children or whoever I want will be interested in following what I wrote in my will, then that money, that exorbitant amount of money that I committed myself to, and that all of my wealth and all my estate and all my assets are under lien for, that whole obligation will just be thrown in the garbage if my inheritors will follow my will, my last will and testament. That's called a halachic will. How long does it take? It takes about, you could probably write it out in your own handwriting in about a minute and 10 seconds, or download it even quicker. When should you write your will and with this will finish? And it's just it's a cute idea. There's a pasuk. The pasuk says regarding Yovel, we know that land that you buy is transferred. If you buy a piece of land, you keep it for until Yovel. Yovel has to go back to whomever got it from their father, who got it from their father at the time of Yeshua ben Nun, when we came into Eretz Yisrael. So the pasuk says, "V'haya biyom hanchilo." No, the pasuk says, "Bishnas hayovel hazos tashuvu ish el achuzaso." Then in this year of Yovel, in the 50th year, each person should return to their achuzah, to their land. So the Achronim have a homiletic drushy kind of way of reading into the pasuk. When a person turns 50, when a person is yovel, they should consider the fact that they are going to return to their land, if you know what I mean. And that is the time, that is the tradition in the poskim, the proper time to write a will. It doesn't mean it's a bad omen. It doesn't mean it's bad luck. In fact, some people have written that it's a segula for arichas yamim, the fact that everything is being taken care of, and that's the appropriate time. So we still have time before we have to write our wills, but it is a positive thing because it prevents machlokas. And I think the Chasam Sofer writes, it also prevents lifnei iver lo sitein michshol, because if a person leaves over a scenario where children could, God forbid, fight, and we all know that it caused lots of fights, even among the finest of families, then that person who's letting that happen, in a certain sense, could be violating lifnei iver. So anyway, we should all be zocha to Mashiach, to Tchiyas HaMeisim, to time of only life and nothing but life, and this should all be just an exercise in Talmud Torah, and we won't really need the halacha l'maisa. We'll have arichas yamim v'shanim.